Tonight on Arena. A new documentary on the life and music of Donal Lunny. Steve Wickham and Dee Kinahan perform from Songs and Souls, and a celebration of dance at the Dublin Fringe. If you'd like to text us tonight, arena at rte.ie is the email address, and you'll also find us on X at RTE Arena. Now, first up this evening, two old friends, musician and water boy Steve Wickham and playwright Dee Kinahan. They are longtime collaborators, and the new show is called Songs and Souls, an evening of theatre performance and tunes and songs. And Dee Kinahan and Steve Wickham join me now. Welcome to Arena, both of you sitting on opposite sides of the room.
Hello.
Thanks, Rick.
Tell me about long-time collaborators. How long are we talking, Steve?
I think about 10 years. Myself and Deirdre met about 10 years ago in a folk club in Navan for Oisín Leitch's folk club. And we've been happily creating theatre and music ever since, really.
Yeah. Yeah, it was amazing. It was a moment in time. I was just that these incredible folk clubs were happening in a pub down in Navan, of all places, curated by Oisín Leitch. I mean, just extraordinary musicians. And myself and Steve met, and I had an idea in my head that I wanted to create a play about a woman called Etty Steinberg, who was a young Jewish lady from Dublin who had ended up being murdered in Auschwitz. And I was creating this play, and when I met Steve, I thought I would love to have kind of a play with music, and we began to collaborate on that. And that was the first project, really, that kind of shifted and turned and went many roads, and then became this big play, Tempesta, that we did 2 years ago. And but from that, then we started working for Meath County Council and creating all sorts of pieces, celebrating great writers like Mary Lavin or Frances Ledwidge. And then we started working directly in theatre. I'm writing a play for Stadttheater Mainz, a big state theatre in Germany, about refugees who came to Ireland in the 18th century. And Steve is creating the whole musical suite for that. So it's been quite a jaunt. Yeah.
is that something you enjoy, Steve? Because obviously it's quite different to the music and to the normal band set.
Do you know, Rick? It's my favourite bit of magic. I think an hour and a half of theatre. What happens in that space? I always in its spell ever since I was a kid. Really, so I love working in that field.
And is it a little bit like, and I may be wrong, but working with somebody like Dee, who obviously works in words, is that like working with a lyricist, or is it just a very, very different feeling simply because, you know, Dee's a playwright?
Well, it is different. I mean, Deirdre's, if I don't mind saying so, Deirdre's amazing to work with. Her voice is very strong, you know, theatrically or in theatre. But no, it is different than a lyricist, I think, working with great lyricists, because to quote the obvious, you've only got 3.5 minutes in a pop song to get an idea across. You've got 70 minutes maybe in a play. You're also working with silence, which we don't as musicians really inhabit the world of silence. So that's challenging and beautiful thing to work with for me anyway.
And there's a flip question for you in this as well, Dee, because normally as a playwright, most of the time you don't necessarily work with large amounts of music, but this is a very, very different discipline to take your words and then have Steve add music to them.
Absolutely. And it's kind of changed the way I write. You know, since I've started working with Steve, and we work with Lisa Lam and Wayne Sheehy and other musicians as well, it's pushed me into a more lyrical style of writing, which is quite liberating as well, you know, like sometimes to kind of break out from the realism and go into the kind of hearts and minds and kind of come at creating a theatre piece in a whole new way. I mean, in fact, we're working on a new piece at the moment, John Boyle O'Reilly. It's a new piece about this Fenian from County Meath who was arrested and transported to Australia and escaped and on a boat. And I've actually come at it musically and written a kind of a 12 stanza kind of poem that is surrounded by music, and I've never written this way before. So it's very exciting and dynamic, and also I think I learned a lot about how, you know, Steve and musicians work. In a way, it's the same. We're all inspired by our audience. We're all inspired by the people around us. And a play and a song start in the same way. It might be meeting somebody at a bus stop or in a coffee shop, and there's something about the sadness in her eyes or the way he takes his spectacles out of his pocket that makes you think about that human being and who they are. And next minute, you know, they're a character and they're walking around their head and they've a story, and it's exactly the same with Steve's songs.
We're here to talk about Songs and Souls specifically, which is the next piece the two of you are doing together. Maybe talk to me a little bit about how you started for that particular collaboration and what's ended up in this show. How did that work? Maybe Steve.
Well, as I said, we've been collaborating. So I've been writing songs for Deirdre's Productions. We did Tempest there 2 years ago, and I met a beautiful poet in the Anna McCurrig called Javier Chiepo, and he had a lyric that was based on the Spanish Civil War. So I put that to music, and it became a song. It became a kind of a pivotal song in the centre of the play. So again, with the Ledwidge and the Mary Lavin, taking the words. I'm not a lyricist per se, although I do write lyrics, but using those as the foundations for a song. And so we'd collaborated so much together, myself and Deirdre, over the last 10 years, that we had these bits of songs and bits of theatre that stories about. As Deirdre says, you might meet somebody on a bus, you might see somebody. Everybody has a story. We're connected to our own story, and it's kind of recognizing those as individual things outside of the confines of the construct of a play, if you like.
Okay. And then we were invited by a festival in Meath. It's a food festival around Samhain, and they asked us, would we put a show together? So we put the show together called Food for the Soul, and it was a series of characters from my plays and some of Steve's songs, and then Steve kind of playing in and around my performances. And we were surprised by the response. Audiences really took to it and loved it. So then we morphed that into this show, Songs and Souls. And we've had a couple of outings. We did the Cork Midsummer Festival in a fabulous venue, the PAV. I don't know if you know it. It's an amazing kind of really much loved venue in Cork. And now we've been invited to do it in Sheemsa Tíre in Kerry. And we're doing it in the Seamus Heaney home place in September. So it's kind of lovely. It's kind of taken feet of its own, and it's a bit different. But again, who doesn't connect to characters and stories and music? So we love doing it.
I'm conscious we haven't had anything from either of you yet so far. So Steve, you're going to sing a song for us. What are you doing?
I'm going to sing about a character I met on the streets of Paris. I used to work in the bank, Rick, and one day I told my parents I was leaving to go to live in Paris. And I met this old man in Paris, and this song about him. And the wind she blows to the calling of the moon, and the leaves fall by the blowing of the wind. Next the tree lay bare round the falling of the leaves, and Pascal walks the leafy boulevard. I hear your name, Pascal, and I cry. He lays his body down by the dirty old canal, and sleep comes slow, 'cause he's bothered by the smell. He dreams he is a bird, a beautiful white swan, and he doesn't want to wake, 'cause the dream's so good. I hear your name, Pascal, and I cry. Someone shines a light, it wakes him from his sleep. It's pouring down with rain. It's time to move along. And deep down in his coat, he's looking for a light. And he wonders to himself, how did it ever get this bad? When the morning shines a light on you, Pascal, then I cry. And the morning gives her heat to you, Pascal, then I cry. Et le vent qui souffle à l'appel de la lune, et le feu qui tombe sous la bourrasque, ne reste que l'arbre nous. Après leur chute, et Pascal descend, descend, descend le boulevard au Feuillement. La 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 la.
Is Steve Wickham. Pascal is the song. That's absolutely fantastic, Steve. I'm interested in the idea of, and you mentioned it and I didn't quite get to it, but that some of this stems from a food festival. It's that idea that art and work like this doesn't necessarily belong within kind of quite strict boundaries, or doesn't necessarily belong within literary festivals, arts festivals in general. Do you find that? Do you find that there's a more open and a more welcoming space for projects like yours outside of that?
I think so, Rick. Yeah. And I think I've been working in theatre for 30 years and I've always loved collaborating with choreographers and designers and dancers and musicians. But I find in the last kind of 10 years in particular, there's more of a melt and more of a kind of a swim. People are making art and story in new ways. And I do think that those old boundaries have kind of broken down. And I think it's for the benefit of everybody, because everybody is an artist. Like Steve and I were having a chat before this show. And like, what's the most important thing for us, in, no matter what we're creating? It's the audience. It's the people in the room. It's that connection. It's that kind of communal moment where we all sigh, or we all wonder or think or fall in love with Pascal on his boulevard, or, you know, and I think COVID really sharpened our senses around that and made us realise how kind of lonely life could be, or sterile life could be, if we couldn't all come together and celebrate humanity, prod humanity, explore humanity, send up humanity, laugh together, cry together and feel together. So I'm a real fan of that kind of collaboration. And like I work, as I said, like not only in Ireland, but internationally. And even the new show that we're doing, Refuge, it's a mixture of German actors and Irish actors, an Irish director, Jim Culleton, German designers. It's going to open in Germany. It's going to come to Ireland. And there's, like, Steve has created an extraordinary suite of music, and there's dance in it as well. And, you know, it's just brilliant. It fires everybody. you know, really fires you.
For this particular show, for Songs and Souls, tell me about some of the characters from your plays that are making reappearances here.
Well, a couple of, you know, my favourite ladies. I write a lot of women, and I've had a real privilege to give voice to so many women over the years. But there's one in particular, Moira, who is in a play called The Saviour that I wrote for Landmark Productions 3 years ago. And it opened in New York and then had a great run here in the Dublin Theatre Festival. And she's kind of fierce and feisty and fragile and she comes to a sad end, but we meet her at a moment of kind of great joy in her life. So I love to bring in Moira, and then I bring in some characters from The Unmanageable Sisters. That was a big play that I wrote for the Abbey, 15 women in a kitchen in Ballymun. But I also have this lovely character called Joseph Grace, who's been haunting me for about 10 or 12 years. I first came across him when I was researching plays for the commemoration period, and he's kind of sat on my shoulder. He's a young man who joins the British Army at 1914, and he finds personal liberation in a prisoner of war camp. And it's actually based on a true story. So I bring Joseph in, and that full production won't premiere until next year. So sometimes the audience get to meet characters from plays that haven't actually yet hit the stage.
Okay, what are you going to perform for us now?
What I'm going to perform for you tonight is a little piece of Moira from The Saviour.
Great.
Moira is sitting up in bed having a cigarette. She is 67 years old. So am I gone to the dogs altogether at the end? Or is this right? I wonder, will you tell me, Jesus? I don't know your mind anymore. But I am enjoying the fag. Yes, I am enjoying the fag. And the sex. Which was a surprise, I can tell you. Because sex has always been a matter of mechanics for me. But you know that, don't you, Jesus? You've been with me long enough. Sex has always been a means to an end. Foisted on me when I didn't want it, or offered up for a bit of peace. But this was different. Wasn't it? This was... What would you say, Jesus? Or did you scarper? Did you bolt when we got to the dirty bit? No doubt you did. No doubt you headed off somewhere a lot purer, like Crowpatrick or Medjugorje or Tibet. I always think it must be nice and pure up there in Tibet. Up in the highlands where the white mountain tops touch the clouds and ne'er a human, ne'er a sinner in sight. That must be a relief. That must be a nice break for you, Jesus, where you can just sit yourself down and have a breather and look at all the beauty your father created and not be being bothered by world wars or mass murders or screaming owl ones having sex. And much healthier, with all that clean air. I'll tell you, I'm glad you got out. I'm glad you headed off. You should have headed off. And not be caught up in this bedroom, in this bed, with the heaving and shunting that was me and Martin. Martin! Even the sound of his name feels delicious. Marcheen, strong and sudden, isn't it? Like a shock, penetrating. Get a grip on yourself, Moira Sullivan. I can hear you say that, Jesus, and you're right. Do you know you're right? I'm acting ridiculous at my age, and he down there, Martin, down there in my kitchen, making me coffee. Coffee. Honest to God. He makes me feel like a movie star. I mean, Colm never made me coffee when he was alive. I don't even like coffee. But I didn't want to say that to Martin. Didn't want to spoil the moment.
Oh, wonderful. Dee Kinahan, Steve Wickham, thank you so much for coming in and joining us on Arena tonight.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thanks a million, Mick. Thank you.
Dee Kinahan and Steve Wickham will be performing at Sheem Satira in Tralee on Saturday, August 30th. Tickets from sheemsatira.com/events and also at the Seamus Heaney Home Place on Saturday, September 6th. SeamusHeaneyHome.com for more information. No, you haven't switched on the wrong radio station at this hour of an evening. That is Megha and Michael Sambello doing Maniac. Variations for Two Disabled Bodies is a new dance piece created by and performed by artists Bobby Byrne and Sosoni Kallig, known collectively as Sobo. In 50 minutes, they are exploring their lived experience of disability and difference, as well as their friendship, all to a soundtrack that takes in 80s pop, classical music, and some contemporary Irish folk as well. Variations is premiered at the Project Arts Centre next month as part of this year's Dublin Fringe Festival. Soso Nichelli is with me in studio. Bobby Byrne joins us on the line. Soso, you've come from Ballymena today. What were you doing?
Yeah, I work, part of my practice is very community-based, so I head out to different centres, whether it's social housing or newly immigrated communities or cross-community projects. And so today I'm covered in paint and I'm wearing my painting overalls, so I'm ready to go, Rick.
I can vouch for this. Bobby, you're taking part in a course in Cardiff on Baroque dance.
That's right, yes.
Tell me a little bit how the two of you met for the first time.
Ooh. We met for the first time through Inclusive Dance Cork, which was like one of the first courses of its kind on the island of Ireland, specifically in inclusive dance. It's one of the only courses that existed in Europe on the subject. And it was through University College Cork. And Bobby was the first person to apply for the programme and I was the last, which is the most on-brand thing for our friendship.
It really is.
and maybe explain to those people who don't understand an inclusive dance course like that. What does that involve?
I guess inclusive dance is the idea of blowing wide open the idea of maybe what people expect of dance. When we work inclusively, we're thinking not just of disability, we're thinking of geography, we're thinking of circumstances, parenting, caring, all the different things that can remove you from the space of dance. So dancing inclusively, although Bobby and I are disabled, our practice is also led in the idea that everybody can dance no matter where they're based, who they are, their own relationship to dance. It's the idea, I guess, of saying where there might be a separation between what is a dancer, we're removing that idea. And the idea with inclusive dance is everybody's a dancer, but we're specifically disability led.
Bobby, talk to me a little bit about Variations for Two Disabled Bodies. What is it?
Well, it's kind of a hybrid of performance, lecture and dance theatre. And in it, we are exploring our own lived experience of disability and other differences and how the two of us have found a lot of support in each other and our shared experience and how mutual support is really important for everyone, but especially those in any kind of marginalised community at all.
And how did you become interested in dance in the first place?
Me personally?
Yeah.
I came to dance quite late in life, at about 20. I started off studying martial arts and then kind of randomly went to a dance class and just fell in love with the activity straight away. At the time, I was there was a single company in Ireland that was doing inclusive dance work, maybe in a less expansive way than what's also said, more specifically work that involved people with disabilities in dance, which was quite radical at the time. And the lady running that, Cathy O'Kennedy, was a huge reason for why I became interested in dance and decided to pursue it as a profession.
And if you don't mind me asking, what's the nature of your disability?
Well, my disability goes by the charming acronym UCBED, which means unilateral congenital below elbow difference disorder, disability, this was exploring the show.
I'm laughing because it is from the script.
This is almost directly from the script. Yes. What it means is, I can't do the physical demonstrations, but what it means is that in my case, one of my arms terminates at about elbow length, and it has two small fingers and no thumb. And so it effectively means I'm operating with one hand.
Okay.
That's the rudiments of it.
Okay, we're going to talk an awful lot more about the show, but it is 7 o'clock. So, é sin agus níos mó in níon na nóachta ó léibh anocht ag Marian ní chúlú.
Gur amagad a rúg agus go mbeannaí díoraíb. Dúirt Kennedy, mílite thiar a NATO gur a córa mocánta go bunneamh faoi thar an na góra TV an le gairid faoin gagas an Úcráin. Dreastal na cín fórne ón dáithean dig agus fuig go thiar in NATO ar a gruinniú ar nasc físe agus phléisead rúint ábhar cosú leis na borantais thlándála gan réaltas i gíomh sa gás agus gonionar cóin tú síochán leis an rúis. Dúrú a rátis héis an chruiniche gur síochán charam Wuan san Úcráin an chlachas múd ar a bádirí na gúnaí ag tír in NATO. Dúirt ar a graiachtrach an na rúise Sergei Lavrov nach de gachéin vlas es na kóratí seo, kóratí nar a bant na pártig an rúis lehob. Dúirt Israel gúil tar le fís a chór ar 6,000 Saidur Kultaka, la gana mon shervise, salagadur tusles en nunra taliaki machiyana, et chahir yaza. Dirt effigig milite gul fogru gachor egna saiduri Kultaka, snalaintisha machrun, agus gmedjish la galer dulgus an chied viele. Captor gudur ardu gus wasle million palestinich imachtas agantar, nervis atsuchi nu la galer waskantab sakri in yeshkert yaza. Khan, tira an nirhid, Plan Israel. Dir Palestini gul dian huomal ar bon a gair yes a hanahin agus gul taili in chin sani nu imir a dzehe. A gúr to Westminster a London hasnan yuv kudu sheer cause Liam O'Gianni. Shachmna na fichad gwish on rap group a gael gen nikap as twish gardaidan gudi on cheo la fichad gan visha hagan. Ta kaid shkevlahodach da koronelie fwy gra bratach ar wain le Hezbollah ar umparegge kiolchar ima London imi na sauna sa kaitse ach seanan cha an chúsh a ta koronelie. Maori na erin dli gra shevi ag na hudrash le kaid a chor ilie Iani, agus ó tharla gur an tréifhse sin caite sa mealtaine nuair a cúisiú bheith dosach gúil sé de gearra go gahiméach an cás. Dúirt an breithimh sa gúirt an nuamh go ndéanaí cine faoin gás ar an 6 lá fichead go bhíomh an an óvair. Deir a dráma chur an seirbhísí trénach an luas ar fálim lá clia go mbeidh chuidig an lína dhearg ag droithead go go chiorse dúnta ar feh 7 lá eile ar a laid mar gheallt ar ghamáiste rinne tinin sin a nné. Cathair obair agus cigireachtaí dhionan sin sa le maith ar an ann an droithead a oscailt i ríist. An aimsir fanna sé teirim agus beidh sé scamalach a gcuid wagon tír an chadelagan lá. Fanna sé teirim mór an chulichard a nocht freisin agus bei paistí ceobhrán a nátachí idir 6 géim agus 310 Celsius a bhessan tuchtas ísle. Bu bhinni ad príomhscéalta na nuíochta agus an aimsir fai láthair ar eisina sé gric.
And Gurma Hagut Awarian, you are listening to Wednesday Night's Arena, and I'm talking to Soso Nikali and Bobby Byrne about variations for two disabled bodies at this year's Fringe. I am conscious I didn't contextualise really why we played Michael Cimbello's Maniac at the top of the show. So it's part of the humour that's in this show, and it's a really important element of it.
Yeah, I think we have a... I work a lot with an organisation in Belfast called University Atypical, which is kind of like our national arts organisation for disabled arts. And we always have this idea of like, you know, we don't do pity. Don't pity us as disabled people. And I think what was really empowering for Bobby and I in like trying to communicate our experience was like being disabled and like the experience of being disabled by societal norms. Yes, it is sad at times. It's also really funny sometimes. And like, there's so much joy and like, you know, there's so much humor to life whenever you experience it so differently. So like, our inspiration with Maniac, Bobby, and I still have the debate about it to this day, which is like, I was the one who pushed for it. And Bobby's like, please, no. And I was like, no,
I can understand why, by the way.
Yeah. I'm lightly traumatized by hearing it the first thing. I'm not going to lie.
And I was like, no, Bobby, so we'll wear leg warmers and like we'll have the Jane Fonda. It'll be great. Basically, our hope was just that you don't see queer disabled aerobics instructors on the TV. And we wanted to reclaim that. And a lot of our work is the idea of reclaiming, I think, spaces that maybe we haven't been in traditionally, or people like us haven't been in traditionally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm conscious I haven't really asked you about the nature of your disability either. You were one of Ireland's first professional disabled dancers.
I still struggle with the idea of being a dancer.
Okay.
To this day, it's actually something Bobby and I talk about a lot, and we talk about a lot in the show. Mm-hmm. I think coming from I'm a disabled multidisciplinary, I'm definitely not the first professional disabled dancer, and I still struggle with the idea of even seeing myself as a professional dancer. I sometimes, even though we're doing a dance show and I'm dancing in a dance show, I still struggle with that label. And I think it's to do with internalized ableism and the idea of what disabled people can do. My own disability, I jokingly refer to myself as a disability triple threat. So I'm neurodiverse, I have a physical disability, and I also have a mental health condition. And that's how I've always referred to myself. And like, I think, reclaiming that, I would call myself the Beyonce of disabilities. I'm a triple threat. It's fine. I'm good. And I think as well, that kind of humour, even in how I'm explaining myself now, both it makes people feel comfortable as well to talk about disability when a lot of people wouldn't feel comfortable. And I think growing up in a very Irish family where we maybe didn't touch on issues that were maybe a bit uncomfortable, approaching it with humour just broke right through.
Bobby, I wanted to ask you and Soso, you come from quite different backgrounds, obviously, as we've been talking about, but you're now having to speak on stage. What's mm-hmm. that like for you?
It's utterly terrifying and completely out of character. I have always avoided making any kind of sound on stage, if at all possible. Even occasionally when asked by choreographers to like make noise, even if it's not words, just vocalizations, I would die inside every time. And that would always be the worst part of any show. And now I'm in two shows where I'm expected to deliver actual monologues to an audience in my actual voice.
Yeah, I was going to say, and here you are. So what's changed?
I think one of the things that's changed is that this is something I've really learned, at least partly, largely through Soso, is to be a lot more interested in the narrative of a piece as opposed to just the movement of it. I used to be very abstract, maybe, in my concerns about dance. I didn't really think too much about what movement meant. I thought it had value on its own, and I still think it has value on its own, but I'm interested now in exploring the meaning of those things. And Soso's background in theatre and poetry means that the meaning of words is something they're very keenly attuned to, and I think I'm kind of responding to that, really.
I'd like to get another piece of music in if I can. So Variation starts with a piece of music by Bela Bartok, Mikrokosmos. What was it about that made you think it would be right for the show?
We were really interested in this idea of the preparatory exercise in dance classes and dance spaces. And the fascinating thing about, Mikrokosmos isn't one of the better known works. It is a known work, but when you think of Bartok, it might not be the first piece, the first work you think of. But what we find fascinating was it takes a journey from the real basics, like a scale, parallel motion, rhythms, and then slowly but surely builds it from that simple foundation right through to really complex sequences at performance level for classical pianists. Mm. So for us, taking our experience. And we started when we did our Dance Ireland residency, which is actually where we came up with the kernel of this show. We started with very preparatory exercises. So we liked using the music and developing up the waist towards something more complex. But our initial center of that idea was, what movements, like really simple movements, do we either struggle with or that we excel at? And then how do we make choreography around those?
Okay, let's have a listen to just a little piece of that. Yeah, that's absolutely gorgeous. It's lovely. I want to ask maybe both of you, maybe Bobby first, what would you like audiences to take away from this show?
I would like audiences to go away from the show, A, amused, first of all. We really want this to be a show that's, you know, funny and amusing. But I would also like people to be thinking a little bit about how their own bodies move and work.
And so?
I think this is both a show specifically for the disabled community and those who don't have direct experience of disability. So we've tried, I think it's really important to us that our disabled audiences are catered to, so that we have our ISL interpreter for all performances, and all performances are creatively relaxed. They're not just, we don't just have the audience lights up. We're thinking about ways to inbuild those things. So I want our disabled community to come away feeling like that was a show made for me. And I want our non-disabled community to come away feeling like they're more able to talk on the issue of disability, because disability is going to affect it affects everyone at some point in their life, whether they themselves become disabled or acquire a disability, or they experience somebody acquiring a disability or born with a disability. So opening up a channel that people can then go home and talk about those issues and say, this feels really good for me and my body, like Bobby's saying, Bobby put it beautifully there, Bobby. And that they're able to sit around the dinner table after coming to see it and go, what feels good for you?
Yeah.
And I think that's where I'm excited.
And it's just been great talking to both of you about the show tonight. It is Variations for Two Disabled Bodies, and it's at the Project Arts Centre from the 10th to the 13th of September as part of the Dublin Fringe Festival. And you'll find more details, as with all of the Fringe Festival shows, at fringefest.com. And you're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena. Filmmaker Nuala O'Connor's new documentary, In Time, is about the masterful Donal Lunny, a founding member of Planxty, the Bothy Band, and Moving Hearts. His pivotal role in the revival and reimagining of Irish traditional music over the last six decades is impossible to overstate. The film focuses on Lunny's unique creative instincts and practice to tell a story of memory and a story of music. It shows his life as a musician, composer, producer, and mentor to a whole new generation of players. In Time will be screened as part of the Irish Film Institute's Documentary Festival next month, and I am delighted to be joined by the director of the film, Nuala O'Connor. Nuala, welcome to Arena. How did this documentary come about?
Thank you very much, Rick. It came about because Donal actually asked me would I be interested in doing it, and you don't say no to a question like that. So all I stipulated was that I think Donal may have been thinking of television broadcast, and I just said, I'd like to make a film. I had actually made a documentary many years ago in 2005 with him and for television. And it wasn't that I thought it was bad or anything, but it was a television format, which meant 52 minutes, which wasn't just long enough. I just thought this, a film about an artist as kind of monumental and important and significant as Donal needed, and the story was so interesting and so artistic that it just needed a film medium, I thought. And so so he was fine with that, and away we went. And then it took a good few years to get it to the point where we were actually funded and able to shoot, but with the support of the then film board, now Fish Aaron, we did. And Cumann Síne Amháin, then BAI and RTE and UCD. So it took a while to put everything together. And then so we eventually were able to start shooting in at the beginning of 2024.
I'm interested in the choice that you make, because from the very beginning, this is a very visually striking film and you've chosen to shoot it in black and white. Why so?
Well, I can't claim credit for that. I worked with a DOP called Colm Hogan, whom I had worked with twice before on two film projects, neither of which were black and white. But he said, you should do this in black and white. And as soon as he said it, I never even said, why do you say that? Or, no, I don't think so. Or let me think about that. I just said, you're right. Yeah. I just thought, he's right. That's exactly. So it was Colm. It was Colm's idea. And I'm so glad that was what I chose, you know.
You visit a lot of places that are important to Donal, especially in Kildare. Those ones were kind of crucial when it came to his artistic formation.
Oh yes. It can't be a place, even though Donal would not be seen particularly as an artist, you know, with a particular place. You know, there's no Yeats country sort of involvement in that sense. But the Kildare is a key. But seen in conjunction with Donegal, where his mother was from, Irish-speaking area in the Donegal Gaeltacht, and his father from Enniskillen. So there's a really strong strand of Northern Ireland in his makeup, because he spent so much time in Donegal. And then Kildare was such a contrast. It was everything. It's like two sides of two opposites, a yin and a yang, and two sides of a mirror or something, a definite case of opposites. So Kildare was English speaking, and it was, it was urban. It was on the train line to Dublin. It had a huge army base there, Bordnamona, semi-industrialised for the times that were in it. And then Donegal, as he says himself, where they took off their shoes when they went up there in June and they put them back on again in September to come back home. And they spoke Irish a lot of the time. His grandparents didn't have any English. So he had a most unusual, if you like, childhood of doubles, all the way along, and he's always been able to contain multitudes.
Yeah, they're contrasts, but they're kind of complementary as well at the same time, and they both do seem to have immense importance when it comes to him as a performer and as a musician. That there's a section in the film where he talks about disappearing out from the house very early on after school and then frequently coming back incredibly late because his parents wouldn't know where they were. And that was mostly because he was spending time in nature. And then in Donegal, there's that connection and that route to traditional music that seems to be very, very much a part of his life from very early on.
It was, although he strangely, there were no traditional players of traditional instruments in his immediate family. Mm. And he says that as a kid in Donegal, his people were, you know, he divides the kind of the traditional community into card players or musicians and singers, you know, and his family are notoriously demon card players to this day. They run a mean poker school every other week in Newbridge, and they all convene for that. So he grew up with card playing, but it was very much like a mel. You know, people came in, neighbours came in. It was the same kind of community that you would find in. No, this is not to say that he never heard any music. He did, of course, he did, and he heard singing, but he did not come from a family of musicians, of traditional musicians, you know, the way you often would, this certainly would be the profile of somebody playing traditional music that would be well known always. They grew up with it. But in his case, I think he says in the film that when it came for him to join in the community of traditional musicians and singers, that he said it was seamless for him because of his background, of where he had come from and the communities and the music that he had heard as a child.
Yeah, I'd like to take a clip from the film. Donal, throughout the film, is incredibly insightful about his own work and how he found himself becoming a musician. This one's great. It's himself talking about where he found his niche initially in traditional music.
Because I was drawn to the arrangements and, you know, the chord sequences, that was where I went from, and I took that with me. And when I encountered traditional music, I realised that the music asked for, you know, a structure, and I could hear it. I could imagine it. So I was never drawn to learning the melody and playing the melody. I always wanted to colour it in some way.
I want to ask you, Downing's house in Prosperous, it's an imposing old building and it was crucial to his music. Why was it that important, and what was it like to go back there and film with him?
Amazing to go back there because the lovely people, the Mastersons who own it now, have really left it the way it was. They have secured the house, they've made it dry and warm and insulated. But the door, the front door, which is on the cover of the very first album that was made there with Christy, is exactly the same as it was. The basement is exactly the same as it was when Donal used to go down there. It was then occupied by a family called the Rins, and Christy's sister, Anne, was married to one of the Rins' sons. And it was about a couple of miles from the village of Prosperous, where there was a pub called Dowling's, not to be accused or confused with Downing's. And Dowling's pub was an interesting pub because it was one of those pubs that had music played in it from very early on. From, like, everybody speaks of the 60s in Ireland as if every pub in Ireland had a traditional music session in it, and nothing could be further from the truth. But Dowling's was one where they did, and there were a lot of people who came to work with Bordemona who were from other parts of the country, who played musical instruments, and people around Meath and Kildare and Offaly, I suppose. And as he said himself, he was a 17-year-old kid with a guitar, and they let him play, and he just found his way into the music. And that's why that's important. And the Rins were part of the crowd that went into Dowling's, and he became friendly with them, and they all went down to the house at night after the pubs closed and stayed there until the early hours of the morning. And he did put in the hours. I mean, that is, you know, that was his apprenticeship.
You talk across the course of the documentary to so many musicians and artists who've worked with him over the years, Christy Moore, Paddy Glack and Andy Irvine. There's so many of the collaborators that he was involved with, and they all almost uniformly kind of talk about how unique he is as an accompanying artist, about how he elevated their work and how he made it something extraordinary.
Yes, this is true. And I mean, no academic discourse or analysis or anything else will ever get to the heart of this, because it is magic. And I think Frank Hart says in the film as well, that even though Frank, who's an unaccompanied singer in English, would be changing key maybe, or speeding up or slowing down, as traditional singers do who don't have any accompaniment because there's nothing to keep them corralled, he said Donald seemed to know where he was going before he knew where he was going himself. And so he's a hugely intuitive player. And I think he did all of that because he listened and then played. He had no intermediary. He had nobody teaching him or saying to him, this is how you do it, this is how it's played, you have to do it this way. He just did it, and he has an amazing, a really unique musical intelligence. I certainly have never come across it. And I have met some extraordinary musicians in my life, but I've never, ever come across anything like Donald's, really. He doesn't make much of it himself, and I don't think he has any idea how unique it is.
Yeah, I think luckily he seems to have people around him who are quite happy to do that. I want to take a clip of Christy Moore here talking about Donald's incredibly pivotal role in Planxty.
Planxty couldn't have happened without Donald, because Donald had the facility to create a situation where we could pull together. I mean, a lot of the things that Liam played on the pipes were written by Donald. Neither Liam nor I had the facility to do that kind of thing. Every harmony I sang on Planxty was harmonies taught to me by Donald. Donald would record on a cassette my harmony line, and I would go away and slavishly try and learn it and eventually get it. But like all those lovely lines that Liam plays on different songs, I mean, obviously Liam's playing was purely masterful, and I'm not in any way detracting from Liam. I'm simply saying that on certain songs, like do 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 do, that's the riff that Liam plays on Farmer Michael Hayes. Donald would have written that. Good Ship Kangaroo, Donald wrote that. You know, Liam could play it though.
I'm talking to Nuala O'Connor, the director of In Time, the new documentary about Donal Lunny. Nuala, the film doesn't flinch from his personal life or from his marriages or his relationships or his family?
No. It would always be part of the story. I mean, the life is the life of an artist, driven by artistic priorities all the time, and maybe he kind of thinks himself, I think he alludes to that in the film, that his eye was maybe always on that and not on the other thing. But he was very happy to talk about that. He's lucky that his relationships have largely, you know, been very good. And Judy Lunny, his first wife, is in the film, and you can see how, you know, how good that post-marriage relationship is to this day. His daughter Cora plays with him, and that is one of the standout things, I think, in the film, their performance together. So it has been not untouched by tragedy. As you know, his son died very tragically, and that affected him, as it would any parent at the deepest level. And produced a sublime piece of music, A Lullaby for Shane, which is on audio in the film, not featured as a performance as such. But his responses are both, you know, if you like, at an emotional, personal level, but also at a deeply artistic one as well, which is the way it is with artists.
Just finally, at the very beginning of the film, we learned that Donald became seriously ill last year while you were making the film. And there's an incredibly moving and poignant scene towards the very end of the film where he's playing with Christy Moore in September of last year, where he's clearly not in the same health as he was in the earlier interviews.
No, and he got ill in, you know, two-thirds of the way through the filming, so that slightly skewed the film itself in the sense of how we had to reconstruct it a little bit. And that scene obviously had to go at the end of the film because it would have looked very odd to be anywhere. Its placement in anywhere else in the film would have looked very odd. But I'm glad to say that since then, he came out from hospital that day to do that performance with Christy, and he has come on so much since then. his health has improved greatly, and he is making his way back to full health, I hope.
That's wonderful to hear. It's an extraordinary piece of work. Director Nuala O'Connor, thanks so much for talking to us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
The film is In Time, Donal Lunny, and it screens as part of the IFI Documentary Festival on the 13th of September at 6 p.m. For more information, you can visit ifi.ie. And that is it for tonight's Arena. Show produced by Reg Luby. Research was by Paula Shields. Ollie Hamilton was our broadcast coordinator, and Liam Mullen was on sound supervision. I'm Rick O'Shea. Tomorrow night from 6:30, amongst others, we'll be talking to Pierce Brosnan and Chris Columbus about the Thursday Murder Club. John Creedon is next. Good luck.